SOS from Chrome. Several men have died there only since the fall. Indefinite detention within these four walls. Who here might get sent off to El Salvador? Overwhelmingly only for the crime of being poor. The message unmistakable, which I'm helping the fascists convey. If you dare to cross that border, then you may be held for years at Chrome. Asking why you ever dared to think that you should try. 'Cause now you're in detention, so far away from home. Sending an SOS from Chrome. Mostly they left home for mostly the same reason.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, is it safe to talk about COVID yet? As much as we might like to forget all about what happened just a few short years ago, is it all right now to remember the fear, upheaval, pitting of friends, co-workers, family, and loved ones against one another in a fight over an invisible threat or non-threat to civilization itself? 5 years later, can we finally talk about COVID-19? Debbie Lerman is a retired medical writer and fellow at the Brownstone Institute, whose focus has been the societal and global trends instigating and contributing to the COVID catastrophe. Her research and many articles written for Brownstone has culminated in her newly released book, The Deep State Goes Viral, Pandemic Planning and the COVID Coup. Welcome back to the show, Debbie.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, Debbie, the last time we talked was about 8 months ago. And back then, I just want to go way back just to reiterate or remember what we were talking about in the so much as the Wayback Machine and your article, They Are Scrubbing the Internet Right Now. What's happened in the interim, Debbie, at archive.org and the Wayback Machine? Is it back to waybacking?
You know, that's such a good question. And I actually also look back to our previous interview about that, because you were interestingly the only person who had reached out about that particular article, since most of the stuff that I do is more COVID centric, even though that is very much related. Yes, they've continued, they are archiving. They started archiving, you know, they did the 3 week window of the pre-election, you know, black hole kind of thing. And then they started archiving again. And then they kind of went back and supposedly filled in the blanks. I don't know how one checks whether the blanks are filled in. I mean, there are things, you know, like if you look up New York Times articles and stuff, there's stuff there from those 3 weeks. But what is not there, we will never know, I guess.
Well, and it's such a vast undertaking, and still yet, even because of after what had happened with this, the DDoS attacks and everything else, they're still the only ones doing this, or has anybody moved in to pick up the slack, or some group of other orgs, or is it just back to how it was way back when?
Yeah, I don't know if I have not heard of any other group stepping in, but again, that's not the area that I've been focused on. So ever since that time, aside from checking to see whether they were archiving again and whether they were filling in the blanks, I haven't really, I don't really know if anybody else is doing the work. But what I do know and what I did look into, and I'm not going to give you a lot of details because I haven't refreshed my memory on this recently, but I did look into the financing of it, of that organization. And it's very strange. The whole thing is very strange. The Wayback Machine, is it public? Is it private? Who runs it? How do they run it? Definitely, for sure, they had censorship going on during COVID. So definitely they were working with things like the Internet, the Stanford Internet Observatory and places like that in terms of, you know, putting labels on things, not necessarily taking things down, but putting labels on things like go to the CDC for reliable information about COVID and stuff like that.
Well, it's such an important and massive undertaking. It really should be transparent at the very least and publicly funded, I would argue. Well, now, Debbie, you're over at the Brownstone Institute, as I mentioned, and you were doing all of this research and publishing all these articles during the COVID, which it wasn't necessarily an easy thing to do. Can you tell our listeners who maybe have missed our previous talks who Brownstone is and how it is that they were the only ones or one of the few that would allow this kind of work to go on?
Sure. Yeah. The Brownstone Institute, well, it was founded by a man named Jeffrey Tucker, who was a libertarian. He was a public intellectual working for a libertarian think tank. And he, when the pandemic happened, he had been researching things like quarantine law, like things that libertarians care about, which is situations in which our liberties can be curtailed by the government with no recourse. And interestingly, pandemics and public health are an area in which that can happen pretty easily, even before COVID. So he had been looking into that for a while. But when COVID happened, you know, he was just shocked and frustrated, like I was and some other people were. But he put together a group of scientists who ended up publishing the Great Barrington Declaration. And the Great Barrington Declaration was in October 2020, saying that why are we doing all these things? We should not be shutting down the economy that is actually harmful, and it kills people, and it's harmful to public health. And this is a virus that only affects very old and very sick people. So those are the people that we need to worry about. And then they got a whole bunch of, pushback. And so because none of that information was getting to the public, and Jeffrey Tucker saw that mainstream media was not going to address those issues, he decided to create a platform where those things could be discussed. And that's how Brownstone happened. And I found Brownstone in maybe late 2021. I had been struggling for all of 2020 and all of 2021 before I found them, or at least part of 2021, because I couldn't find a platform that was doing that.
Well, and of course, they were immediately dismissed as libertarian right wing nuts that are virus deniers and all these other things. But this goes beyond political, as the Great Barrington Declaration and the people that signed on to that come from across the political spectrum, as you yourself migrated from what you describe as a democratic liberal lefty kind of position as well.
Yes. So that was the great thing about Brownstone, and about a lot of people in the medical freedom movement come from everywhere, from the right, from the left, from the libertarian. And I don't even like to use the words right and left and liberal and conservative and Democrat and Republican. I don't even like those categories anymore, mm-hmm. because I feel like what's happening in the world is just transcending and completely that those have become irrelevant, in the sense that it is the global overlords and corporations, oligarchs versus the rest of us. It doesn't matter what party's in charge. It doesn't matter who the politicians are. They're all in service of the global power centers. And what we need to do is we need to expose the global power centers and show what they're doing and show how they're affecting our lives, so that we can, you know, hopefully try to resist the next time they try to impose some kind of really big global operation on us.
Well, I would say even more than irrelevant, that it's become a distraction, these labels of left and right. They're not really descriptive of political positions. They're just conveniences that designed, I would argue, to set the hoi polloi against one another while their pockets are being picked by the same people.
I would agree with you completely.
Well, okay, so now, again, the book is out. The Deep State Goes Viral, Pandemic Planning and the COVID Coup. Did you title this, or is this the publisher's idea?
I titled it. So I now, take credit.
Or you're gonna sink with it, too. The Deep State. Now, you know, does that conjures up some pretty dark images. When I started writing this script, the introduction, I was thinking, is it safe? And it took me back to that famous scene from The Marathon Man, that iconic film from the 1970s, where the dentist, the evil Nazi dentist, is torturing well, like maybe paying back what we've gotten from Dustin Hoffman as an audience over the years, but torturing Dustin Hoffman with dental implements and keeps saying, is it safe? Is it safe? And of course, he doesn't know anything. And this all ties in to this spooky underworld where regular people have no idea what's going on below the surface, and they're hapless, and it's terrifying. Can you describe what the deep state is?
Yes. Thank you for that. Yeah, we have to demystify that. So the deep state actually is something very that you can really understand. It's not a whole bunch of people in a dark room torturing each other, although there are that might be, you know, some of that might be going on at any given time. But the definition of the term deep state actually comes from this liberal Democrat guy in, like, I think 2014. He wrote The Anatomy of the Deep State. And his definition of the deep state, which is the definition that I use in the book, is the military-industrial complex plus Wall Street plus Silicon Valley, all operating in an extra-legal, extra-constitutional space where they have no legal, regulatory, or budgetary oversight. So it's basically huge, powerful, and in my book, it actually goes up to the global level because COVID was a global event, and it was run by the global deep state. I also call it the global public-private partnership because it involves a fusing of public and private interests into this one kind of cabal. And so if you want to talk about dark rooms and people plotting things, you can maybe think about the people who are the heads of these companies and the heads of the intelligence and military in all the countries that participated, let's say in COVID, which is all of NATO, all of the Five Eyes, all of the EU, and a bunch of other allied countries. So that's a lot of people. And they are not hiding. They are meeting in various places like Davos with the WEF, or like the Bilderberg Group, or like the Council on Foreign Relations, or there's a million places where powerful people from corporate and government meet. And from nonprofit, obviously, we're also talking about the adjacent not so-called nonprofits and non-governmental entities like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Wellcome Trust and the academic and research institutions, which are all in it because they're all paid, you know, by the cabal. And then we also have behind all of that, if you want to really get into the deep state, is the banking system, which finances all of it. And so it's really the deep state is where very powerful entities create a space for themselves, or we've actually allowed them to operate in a space where there is no oversight. We don't know. We can't control it. We can't oppose it. There's no legal recourse. And the money, it comes from the taxpayers, comes from the, you know, nonprofits and from the businesses, but we don't have any regulatory oversight over what happens with it. So I hope that demystifies it a little bit, because the important thing to understand is that it's not a conspiracy in a dark room between like a few people smoking cigars. It's actually huge, huge structures on a global level that are operating in this extra legal, extra constitutional space. And what they're doing is they're basically just, and this is another thing that, and the man who coined the term, his name is Michael Lofgren. And in Anatomy of the Deep State, he also talks about how what their goal is, like, why are they doing this? It's because when you have big, powerful, rich entities like that, what they want is to maintain and increase their wealth and their power. It's not a mystery at all why they're doing these things. So they want more resources. They want control over the resources, more of the resources. They need the resources in order to run all of their sort of control and surveillance mechanisms, and AI is a big part of that. And they need control over the population because they don't want the population to know what's going on and what they're doing, like during COVID. And they want to pit us against each other, like you said, with all of this fake, you know, right, left, whatever, different political parties and stuff like that. And they also have to control the information. So the other extremely important part of it is, as Lofgren defined it, Silicon Valley and the media. So the social media and the other types of media in terms of information flow. So that's the whole network that actually constitutes the deep state.
And of course, what we're left with, we little people on the surface, is the shallow state, the front-facing facade of the democratic process that we see, especially now, more transparently than ever, is a charade.
Yes. And there is a very big confusion, particularly in what I would call so-called conservative and right-wing circles, where the deep state is often conflated or confused with the administrative state. The administrative state is the bureaucrats. It's the bureaucracy. And yes, the bureaucracy is inflated. And yes, it's crazy how many administrators we have. And, you know, that it's would be great if we could operate on a more lean and a more efficient bureaucratic system, but that is not the deep state. So when people talk about Trump is going to come in and he's going to fight the deep state, if all he's doing is cutting a bunch of bureaucrats from a bunch of agencies, that literally has nothing to do with the deep state. If he goes in and he cuts USAID, which is a CIA cutout, then he's touching the toe of the big state, of the deep state. But that was like one of the only things that Trump came in and did that had anything to do with the deep state. He certainly didn't cut the budget for the military industrial complex, and he's funding to the tune of $500 billion of taxpayer money, this entire AI kind of takeover of our entire system, which is really crazy.
Well, it seems just a dipping of a big toe into the big deep as far as Trump is concerned. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Debbie Lerman. Debbie is a retired medical writer, fellow at the Brownstone Institute. Her recently released book, The Deep State Goes Viral, Pandemic Planning and the COVID Coup, is out. It's available. We'll talk about how you can get it in a minute. But before we get to that, Debbie, you talk about the response now to the COVID threat. And unlike a medical response, the CDC and other health organizations and entities that have rehearsed all this and practiced and are prepared for something like a massive outbreak like this, the response in the United States, at least, was very different than what might be expected. Do you want to describe that?
Sure. Actually, it was in every single country and it was identical. So in every single country, there is a thing called pandemic planning or planning for epidemics and disease outbreaks. And that is where if there is an outbreak of people getting sick with something and they test those people to see what kind of virus or what kind of bacterium is causing the illness, and it's not something that has been identified before, then they can say it's an outbreak of an unknown origin, and maybe it will cause a lot of disease and a lot of death. And at that point, maybe we can call it an epidemic or a pandemic. But public health just says, okay, so let's look at these outbreaks. We'll identify what the pathogen is, and then we will treat the people who are sick and dying. And we will, if we need to, like with Ebola, we will isolate them because it's very contagious. Or if it's like a flu-like illness, we can't isolate enough people because it's already spread in the population. So we're just going to find some treatments that are going to help. We're going to use antibiotics for secondary infections, and everybody else is going to live their life. If we need to increase hospital capacity in certain places where there's, you know, a surge, we'll do that. It's going to happen in different places at different times because that's how diseases happen. They don't happen everywhere at once. There has never been a disease outbreak in the history of humanity that has shut down, you know, the entire world, and there's no reason for that. That's the public health outlook. Then there's the biodefense outlook. The biodefense plan is the plan for biowarfare and bioterror. And that plan is that you lock everything down and you wait for a countermeasure. countermeasure is something that is rushed to the scene with no regulatory oversight, with no legal restrictions on how it's made or how it's developed or how it's distributed, and with no legal liability for anybody who uses it. That's so with COVID, what they did was up until the end of February in almost every country, except China, because China was the first, but except for China and every other country, they were saying, yeah, it's not that serious. It only affects old and sick people, and don't worry about it. And masks don't work. And of course, you know, we'll take care of it like we did any other outbreak, and just wash your hands and stay home if you're sick. That's the public health plan. Then at the end of February, everything kind of like they flipped a switch. There's a chapter in my book about February 27th, which is a really important date because that's when pretty much the entire world switched over to the lockdown until vaccine plan. And then all of a sudden it was like fear porn, 24 hours a day from every media outlet, and massive censorship of anybody who tried to oppose it. And then they suddenly told us that masks work, even though the day before they said they didn't, including Anthony Fauci. And then they said all this crazy stuff like social distancing, which isn't even a thing, that never existed. And it was only intended to make it impossible for people to actually operate businesses, go to school. You know, they had to shut everything down. And then wait for this thing, this countermeasure, which they called a vaccine, but which is actually not a vaccine in any traditional sense. They had to change the definition of a vaccine. It went through a regulatory pathway that is reserved for countermeasures when there is a bioterror or biowarfare attack. And so that pathway, because it's an emergency pathway, it has to happen fast. It makes it so that you don't actually have to do anything, except the Secretary of Health and Human Services has to declare that there's a public health emergency or a risk of a public health emergency, and anything that you're using against whatever it is that's creating the public health emergency is now a countermeasure. And it doesn't have to go through any legal processes that any other medical device or medical medicine ever has to go through. And also anybody who deals with it has total indemnity, legal indemnity, so you can't sue for any damages that it might cause. And they use that for the COVID vaccine, and yet they pretended, and I'm using the word vaccine in quotes, the mRNA shots, but they pretended to the public that the mRNA shots had gone through some kind of, you know, clinical trial process that was overseen by the FDA, not true, that it had been approved through some kind of process the way that other drugs and devices are approved, not true at all. And so then that was mandated basically for the entire world's population. So.
And all at warp speed, of course, too.
And all at warp speed, exactly. And so it's the everything that happened in COVID is the diametrically opposed to what one would do if one were following just a regular public health response to a disease outbreak. Well, and that's why I started researching it, because it was so antithetical to everything that I knew just from being a medical writer and having a husband who's a doctor and looking into the studies and into the statistics. I knew that something was wrong and that they were lying to us. I didn't know why. And that's what the book is about.
Well, the first thing, you know, too, is that in a crisis, the people in charge, the responsible people, don't start running around with their hair on fire. You
right.
know, they say, hey, okay, be cool. Don't panic. You know, we'll get through this, everybody. Because you know that if you do that, you're going to exacerbate whatever the problem is. You know, it's like the old joke, don't panic. You know, I mean, you know, that's just not going to work, dudes, you know. But as you say, that it was fear porn all day long across the medium spectrum. Everybody saying, like, with the music and the death count, even like on PBS, I recall seeing Judy Woodruff sitting there, and they would begin their thing with little biographies of all the people that had died. And it was unprecedented is too soft a word, but it was absolutely incredible. And it really worked to whip up this sense of doom. This is the Black Plague come back from history to us.
Yep. Yeah. And that's what was so scary, is I thought it was so obvious that this was all crazy and that none of this was what we should be doing. I thought people would realize it in like a week or two. I kept telling people, oh, it's okay. In a week or two, they'll understand and they'll go back to being sane and rational. Of course, that did not happen. But the propaganda was perhaps the scariest part of the pandemic, I think, for me, because I didn't think that in the 21st century, after our experiences of all the totalitarian propaganda that we observed and studied for many decades after World War II and after the fall of communism, and we understood what it means to propagandize a population, and that we were immune to that, and we weren't going to fall for that.
There's no such thing as natural immunity to propaganda, it seems, and now it's not over, but we're fast running out of time, Debbie. So I next steps now, because we're getting lulled into forgetfulness. People often there's like a mass amnesia after terrible events like the 1918 flu epidemic, and it falls from memory very quickly, faster than the Wayback Machine. And I feel that we're getting into that right now, where people are starting to forget and they don't want to remember. And yet on the horizon, there is this ominous idea that this is going to come back and that this other shoe is going to drop. What do you think about the prospect of a repeat of what went on in 2020?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, first of all, I'm going to just plug the book for that, because the point of The Deep State Goes Viral is to hopefully make sure that people understand what happened and make sure that they understand that that they can't give into it again. I don't think it can happen again the way that it did. And the reason is there's enough of us now who are aware of it. And interestingly, because it's been so politicized, at least half of the population of the United States is not going to do it, I don't think. If they try to lock us down again, or they try to make us wear masks, or especially if they try to give us a crazy medical injection of an experimental unapproved substance, I don't think a lot of people are going to fall for it. But I do think there's another shoe that I stay up at night wondering what that other shoe is. It could be that they could try another public health scare. Hopefully you and me and a bunch of other people will prevent a lot of people from falling for it. But it could also be a different kind of emergency, because right now what we're doing, that whole extra legal, extra constitutional space in which the deep state operates, that's very much operational right now. And it's operational specifically in the areas of AI, energy. Trump declared an energy emergency the minute he walked into office, so that they could construct a whole bunch of nuclear power plants for AI without any kind of regulation. And AI is also completely unregulated right now in terms of how it's collecting data and how it's creating kind of a control network. So that's where I would look for the next kind of totalitarian move, which is forcing everybody to get digital IDs, putting people on central bank digital currencies so that they can control our transactions. And they started that. They started that during COVID with the vaccine passports.
Well, in Canada, too, the raiding of bank accounts when there was protests, the trucker convoy. And that's something that still hangs over us. How, Debbie, do people get The Deep State Goes Viral?
So it's available on Amazon, print and audio and Kindle. And it is also available for those who do not want to go through Amazon on Lulu.com, Lulu.com. You can just put in Debbie Lerman, The Deep State Goes Viral. And you can also find parts of it, some of the chapters, on my Substack, which is DebbieLerman.substack.com.
That's Debbie, D-E-B-B-I-E, Lerman, LERMAN.substack.com. That's where I read your posts. Debbie, thanks a lot for coming on and talking a little bit about it. I wish you success with your book. I hope that you're wrong about your worst prognoses, or your fears prove unfounded for all of us. And I want to also thank Prasenna Shamagutas, and remind Canadians to keep your eye on Bill C2, the so-called Stronger Borders Act. It ties in very closely with all of these themes that Debbie has written about and that we've talked about on this show for a long time. Thanks a lot for coming on again, eh, Debbie?
Thanks so much for having me. It was great.
That's all I got for this week. Till the next time.
Sending an SOS from Chrome.